وآل محمد.
Bring us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. A report has revealed that Russia and Ukraine were ready for a potential peace deal back in April, but the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson prevented that deal from taking place. Johnson reportedly told Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that even if Ukraine is ready for peace, Kiev's Western backers are not. Who are Kiev's Western backers exactly, and why are they dictating terms to Kiev? And what if peace had taken place? How many Ukrainian lives would have been saved? And what about European economies? Would they have been relieved from the soaring energy bills and the looming energy crisis? These are just some of the questions we'll be asking on tonight's Spotlight. And here are the guests that we have. Activist and commentator Don DeBar joining us from Westchester, New York. And we also have journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich joining us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. DeBar. According to multiple former U.S. officials, back in April, Russian and Ukrainian negotiators appeared to have agreed on a peace deal, but the British Prime Minister Boris Johnson prevented that deal from taking place. What do you make of this news, and why would peace not be on the agenda of Europe and the U.S.?
Well, let me answer the last question first. You could look at what Adolf Hitler wrote in 1922, was it, I think? His little jail cell tome, My Struggle, looking eastward for the opportunities for empire for Germany, substitute for 200 years of colonizing the world like Britain and France and Spain had done, was to take Russia. And the resources and the population and the real estate itself were enough for Germany to rule the world, in his opinion. And if you look at the material basis of his argument, basically, it's true. The U.S. has been licking its chops, looking at Russia's mineral wealth, its educated workforce, and its vast real estate, its vast footprint on the planet. It's major share of the Eurasian continent. Since 1917, certainly, but even earlier. They bought Alaska from Russia, by the way, and there were people who had ambitions to buy further to the west of Alaska or into Eastern Asia. In terms of the admission that this has been happening and also the fact that the attempt at making peace was thwarted by Washington and London, it's particularly interesting to see that this is being spoken by Fiona Hill and Angela Stent. Fiona Hill was a member of the Trump administration. That much is being credited to her. But she was actually allied with that portion of the Trump administration that were sort of inserted along with those who helped put the dossier together to try to take Trump out. She spent a few hours, something like 10 hours, I think, in secret testimony during the impeachment, the first impeachment trial. Angela Stent also, the two of them are both hardcore Cold Warriors, and they would love to see Russia's government taken down. And so for them to admit that peace was thwarted in April when it was possible between Ukraine and Russia means that this is not some, you know, Russian propaganda claim. These are people who are actually bragging that it was thwarted, because their aim is actually to make Russia bleed as much as possible and see if they can't force some sort of uprising in the country to take a pipe dream. But that's the dream that Langley has right now, and these two people are totally on board with it.
John Bosnich, Boris Johnson reportedly told Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky that even if Ukraine is ready, Kiev's Western backers are not. Tell us more about who are exactly Kiev's Western backers, and why would they not want a peace agreement at all?
Okay, well, we have to start from the basic premise that we're talking about the Anglo-American empire. And I think we should insert the word war empire, because it's not just that they have a functioning empire of economic production, trade routes, and so on, but the key element of the Anglo-American empire is that it is an empire for the purpose of war. One normally thinks that in history wars were fought to acquire resources, to acquire a strategic position, to control trade routes, and so on. But actually, that has evolved over time to the point where war itself is the purpose of the empire, because the biggest possible profit is not from extracting minerals from the ground. It is not from mining gold. It is not from pumping oil, but it is from the purchase, sale, and trade of weapons. So that is the objective of the empire. The empire is based on war itself. It is war with no other goal other than war itself. And that's why the order was given to Ukraine. Not to protect them strategically, not to protect resources, not to end the war, but to keep the war running for war itself.
Don DeBar, the report said Johnson's position was that of the quote-unquote collective West, which feels Putin is not as strong as they initially thought, and they see the war as an opportunity to press Putin. Taking into account the ripple effects, specifically the energy crisis that Europe is facing, would you say that this was a miscalculation?
Yeah, I think there are miscalculations across the board. There's a term that's used in colloquial American English about believing your own, and I'll use the letter substitute BS. It appears that Langley or whoever else is responsible for making policy in Washington has spent much too much time conferring with the propagandists and not enough with the strategists and those taking stock of what goes on in the world in reality. I'd really like to argue with what Mr. Bosch has just said, except I can't find any levers to hang on to argue with it. Certainly, looking at the military budget of the United States alone, let alone Britain, France, et cetera, it is larger than, I believe it's the next 10. And out of that, China has a military budget of about a quarter of that of the U.S. now. It's been forced to scale up. Russia's, the last measurement that I saw comes from the year 2019, was about $65 billion as opposed to the U.S. military budget of between $800 billion and $1 trillion, and that's on the books. And when one looks at what one buys for that on the ground, it becomes clear that the purpose of these budgets is actually, you know, to mask massive theft. You may have a military state whose only purpose is war, but what drives it, I think, in my opinion, is theft, and that war provides an excellent cover, and it is also I've used this phrase three times now in the last couple of days, but a perpetual motion machine almost, self-sustaining, where as the budgets scale up for yet another war, more money is transferred into the pockets of some very wealthy people. It requires a militarization of people all around the event. For example, the U.S. military budget growing means that so will Britain's and France's and Germany's and, you know, and everyone else's. And the people that they aim those militaries at, of course, are forced to scale up. And so everybody makes even more money. And as the weapons are captured, destroyed, and just utilized, used up, they have to be replenished. So it is like a self-perpetuating monster. And it can certainly appear that war is its own purpose. In any event, whatever purpose it is serving, it is sustained by war making for sure.
John Bozich, in addition to that, Secretary of Defense U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin said one of Washington's goals in Ukraine is to see a weakened Russia. Why does Washington want a weak Russia? Unpack Lloyd Austin's comments for us, please.
Well, if Russia is weakened, the ability of the United States to provoke more wars on the Russian borders, not just in Ukraine, but anywhere they can provoke a conflict, in Lithuania, some conflict related to Iran, wherever they can provoke a conflict, it's more business. So we have a really paradoxical situation here where I think your listening audience is going to have trouble grappling with this. When an American weapon or tank or plane is shot down, the loudest cheers are in the United States at the headquarters of the weapons providers, because they can now sell a new tank, a new airplane, a new weapon system to the American government. So it is a perpetual motion machine. The purpose of the machine is war making. And if you can picture this in your minds, if you close your eyes, what you've got is the U.S. taxpayer hooked up to an automatic milking machine. So you've got 300 million U.S. taxpayers who are hooked up to automatic milking machines, which milk them for their money. So the victim of the war is a civilian, and it's the American civilian taxpayer who is being milked 24 hours a day, even when they're sleeping, for their money. That is the paradigm that American citizens live in. And unfortunately, because that's the paradigm of the world we live in, we live in a world full of war, perpetual war.
Don DeBar, as the conflict enters its seventh month, Joe Biden announced nearly $3 billion in U.S. military aid. That support, as stated, will be used for buying and purchasing military equipment for the long term. Does the conflict in Ukraine have the potential of morphing into a war of attrition?
Well, it's already been that. First of all, the numbers that have been discussed recently about aid, quote unquote, to Ukraine, in other words, some of the milking that John refers to, this is someone here that's somewhat dehydrated from having been milked over the last 60-something years. You have a situation where something like $50 to $60 billion in quote unquote aid has been sent to Ukraine since February. Now, no one knows how much of that money actually hit the ground in Kiev, for example, or got dropped off in Swiss bank accounts or whatever. But again, on scale, you know, Russia's military budget of $65 billion is to defend a massive piece of real estate that runs from the Polish border to the Sea of Japan, the Arctic Circle, to China and India, et cetera, and, you know, the Black Sea and all of that. And Ukraine's having a war on just that one little front, and they have as much money passing through their hands as the entire annual budget of the Russian military. So the idea is to have Russia certainly suffer a war of attrition of material. I don't know what kind of fatalities they thought they could impose on Russia's military, but Russia has a population of about four or five times that of Ukraine, and more importantly, I think, the people of Russia are much more supportive of, you know, this is, for them, this is a war of survival. People of Ukraine are divided into half, practically. And so it's a bad idea to conduct a war of attrition because they'll lose. Ask Hitler, ask Napoleon how that worked out.
And John Bozich, Russian foreign minister, in a July interview with the country's state media, said that compromise is no longer an option. These are his words. Even giving Russia all of Donbass is not enough. Now the geography is different. Foreign Minister Lavrov asserted in describing Russia's short-term military aims, that is, it's also Kherson and Zaporizhia regions, as a number of other territories. The goal is not negotiation, but Ukrainian capitulation. So here we see Russia having its own objectives changing now that that window of opportunity for peace has passed.
Indeed, that's the case. But there's a very logical reason for that. Russia entered into this conflict after waiting 8 years through a clear policy of genocide on the part of the Kiev regime against its own ethnic Russian citizens. Russia did something America would have never done, and that was patiently negotiate and attempt to find a peaceful solution. When it was found in April that there was a peaceful solution, then that was scuppered on the side of the Americans. Why? Because the Americans, as we've already said, and my fellow commentator Don DeBar has said, because the Americans are in this for war itself. So then we proceed, and the war has continued since this April attempted peace agreement, and here we are now in September. And suddenly, it's not Russia who's talking about the scuppered agreement, it is America. Which means that America realizes and has leaked this story to the media, because America realizes that now not only are they losing territory, they're losing the entire war that they intended to continue forever, because Russia is winning so quickly and so overwhelmingly that the war that they wanted to have last forever is not going to last as long as they want it. So not only have they lost the territory and the control of Ukraine, they're actually losing the ability to fight war forever. So it's a double loss for America, and therefore America leaks this story to try to put pressure for a quick, peaceful solution. Too late, gentlemen, you missed your chance. It is now a war for strategic control of the territory that America had used and tried to turn into a NATO base to destroy Russia. Russia must stop that objective from ever happening again, and Russia will do so. I fully expect Russia to take control of the entire seacoast of the Black Sea so that the rump Ukraine ends up being a landlocked mini state that has to actually give its own western territory to Poland in order to survive.
Don DeBar, let's turn our attention now to Europe. Massive inflation, a cost of living crisis, an energy crisis. Some countries like the UK having its citizens face unprecedented energy bills, with many European countries facing energy rationing, high oil and gas prices as well. This is all, of course, the fallout of Ukraine conflict. How much is Europe losing in all of this in comparison to the United States? What's the cost of this conflict and its repercussions for Europe as opposed to the U.S.?
Well, you have to distinguish between the elite in Europe and the population, you know, the billion or so people that live in Europe, because there are two different sets of interests there that are being expressed without any, you know, mask at this point. I think you could say that this was articulated out of the mouth of the German foreign minister this past week at the 2000 forum, that she said this is the highest ranking Green Party official in the world. She's the foreign minister of Germany, which is a pretty high office. That's von Ribbentrop, who held that office under Adolf Hitler. She said, in essence, that things are bad and they're going to get worse for the German people, and that the German people are going to be looking to their politicians for relief. And she said, in essence, I know we've promised that we would make your life better, we're going to do what we can, but we also promised Ukraine we would stand with them, and we intend to do so. And so they are going to double down regardless of the consequences. Now, I thought back when Donald Trump mentioned about NATO being obsolete, that he was taking a look at the fact that there was austerity across Europe for, at that point, about 30 years, and that the tax, essentially, that NATO is on the economies of the European countries was exacerbating the problem, and he saw that as something that needed to be resolved by, on the one hand, taking it off the back of American taxpayers, and the theory was that the Europeans would pick it up, but I think what was really behind it was, in essence, the European populations would not allow that, and NATO would finally be put to bed where it belonged. Those contradictions that exist in those European countries with the people against their own economy basically being screwed by the elite have only intensified since 2016, and particularly since February. And so doubling down, in my opinion, is likely to produce not just allow the bubbling unrest already to express itself, but it may actually produce some revolutions in Europe. And I'm not talking hyperbole here. In France, the yellow vests have not demobilized, and now that you're talking about people actually freezing to death this year, that was enough for Paris Commune, 200 years ago. And so we may be looking at the EU dismantling, but more importantly, some sort of unrest that hasn't been seen perhaps since the beginning of the 20th century.
John Bosnich, the U.S. has on many occasions called Iran a destabilizing factor. Iran's foreign minister, who's just visited Russia, presented Moscow with an unnamed European leader's proposal for a peace initiative to end the war. The Iranian foreign minister said their ideas to help establish peace and stop the fighting in Ukraine, and I shared these ideas with Mr. Lavrov. Who's the destabilizing factor now?
Well, it's obviously the Anglo-American war empire, which is the destabilizing factor here. And they're having a little bit of trouble justifying continuing the war to their own populations. So they are presenting the war as Russian aggression, which it is not. It is a Russian response to NATO aggression in Russia's hinterland, directly next to their capital. So the entire, this is what George Orwell in 1984 called black-white. Whatever is white is called black, and whatever is black is called white. They are making the aggressor out of the defender, and they're making the defender into the aggressor. This is a lie which cannot be foisted on the people of Europe, because the people of Europe have some media that are independent of Washington. It can be pushed on the people of America because they don't listen to any media in any other language other than English, and the only other purveyor of the story is England, which is Washington's partner. But the story is running thin, and as the winter comes, Europe is going to be destabilized, and America is now afraid that maybe its European military colony called the EU could fall apart. And there are problems in Hungary, and there are problems in Poland. And that is what America is afraid of, because so long as it can keep the EU together, it can use the EU to force the NATO partners to reimburse America all the money that they've spent. So they not only rob the American taxpayer, they then go to the EU and NATO and ask them to pay America back. It's a double ripoff of their own people and the people of Europe.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. That's all the time we have for tonight's show. Activist and commentator Don DeBar joining us from Westchester, New York, and journalist, activist, and political analyst John Bosnich joining us from Belgrade. Thanks for contributing to the program,
thank
and
you.
Also a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
Thank you too.
It's good night for
tell
now.
John, thank
see you next
too
time.
For me.
insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran, by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم قالوا أرجه وأخاه وابعث في المدائن حاشرين.
They said, postpone the matter of him and his brother and send among the cities gatherers.
يأتوك بكل سحار عليم.
Who will bring you every learned, skilled magician.
Dear listeners, we have reached the 36th verse of chapter Shu'ara. The verse says, قَالُوا أَرْجِهْ وَأَخَاهُ وَابْعَثْ فِي الْمَدَائِنِ حَاشِرِينَ. They said, give him and his brother respite and send heralds into the cities to collect. Also the 37th verse, يَأْتُوكَ بِكُلِّ سَحَّارٍ عَلِيمٍ, that they bring you all skillful sorcerers. As you were with us, we mentioned already that the age in which Pharaoh lived was the age of wizardry and sorcery. So, in this scenario, Pharaoh tries his best to call wizards to be at his service. He also calls the miracle that Moses brought to him, as we explained in the previous episode, he calls Moses a skillful sorcerer to overshadow this clear miracle. Of course, after much counseling, his close companions told Pharaoh not to haste in the affair of Moses and his brother, but give them some respite, and then send some summoners into the cities of Egypt to collect all the skillful sorcerers. So the verse says, قَالُوا أَرْجِهِ وَأَخَاهُ. They said, give him and his brother respite. The pronoun he in arjih is referring to Moses. And this is what the companions of Pharaoh told him as advice, as he asked them, فَمَاذَا تَأْمُرُونَ. So what do you command in the 35th verse? So, as a matter of fact, Pharaoh's companions were either deceived or consciously accepted Pharaoh's accusation of Moses, and they planned that he was a sorcerer, and they had to resort to better wizards to fight him. They thought that fortunately there were lots of skillful wizards in the vast country of Egypt, and if Moses was a wizard, they would be able to gather so many skillful wizards that the secrets of Moses would be revealed. So the verse continues, يَأْتُوكَ بِكُلِّ سَحَّارٍ عَلِيمٍ, that these heralds and summoners bring to you all skillful sorcerers. We'll talk about some of the words used in these verses after a short break.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qum.
The verse says, وَبْعَثْ فِي الْمَدَائِنِ حَاشِرِينَ, brothers and sisters, send heralds into the cities to collect. The word, the Arabic word حَاشِرِينَ, is derived from the word حَشْر, that originally means to mobilize people for war or such like. So, now, Pharaoh asks the companions to call the summoners and send them into the cities to mobilize wizards at any price to fight Moses ala nabina wa alihi wa alayhi salam. There are some points regarding these two verses. The first point is that if the experts of one society, they are not committed, they do not have a single rightful criterion, they will be resorting to anything to achieve money. In this case, the experts of that time, the sorcerers, they try to give services to the pharaoh, to the oppressor of their time, just in order to get some money. The second point is that these oppressors, these ruthless, headstrong people of every society and every era, they do their best, like using the experts of the society to cover the truth in order to stop the well-known people of the society guiding the others. The third point is that Fir'aun and Pharaoh knew that he is up to something really powerful. So he did his best. He summoned up all his power. يَأْتُوكَ بِكُلِّ سَحَّارٍ عَلِيمٍ. He ordered them to bring all the skillful sorcerers, because he knew he had to beat Moses and his brother Aaron. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us. That's all we can discuss about these two verses. We will move on to the next verses in the upcoming episodes. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parstoday.com. Until the next program, Take care.
Things always, but for me, worry ends when faith begins.
Good. If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of Truth. We who are his followers, Imam Hussein's followers, and by order of Hazrat Sajjad, peace be upon him, and recommendation of other infallible Imams, arrange these sustained morning sessions, have the problem. We face tyranny in this regime. We face the cruelty of the oppressors, but we maintain the event of Karbala. Our preachers kept the event of Karbala alive. They kept alive the issue of the resistance of a small group, but with immense faith vis-a-vis the powerful but arrogant regime.
A'udhu billah minash shaitanir rajim. We seek refuge from Satan the accursed, and in the name of Allah, the compassionate, the merciful, we start another episode of the program, The Spring of Truth. Welcome to this program, in which we try to reflect and contemplate and shed some light and paraphrase some of the sayings and valuable words of Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayh, who is the founder of the Islamic Revolution of Iran. He says, the pen can be more creative than the blood of the martyrs. Subhanallah, I really like this sentence. It reminds me of the verse in the Quran that says, Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim, and the very beginning of chapter Qalam, verse number 1, where Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says, Wal qalami wa ma yastarun. By the pen, I swear by the pen and what they write. So, you know, it's totally a strong claim that Imam Khomeini Rahmatullah Alayhi is saying, you know, the person who writes and builds people's beliefs and values can have a tremendous impact on the culture of his or her society. In other words, that person builds people's cultures, and he or she is building a kind of lifestyle for them. These days, I think bloggers and influencers in social media are doing this. Like, you know, the pictures that they post, the videos, the captions that they write, you know, they shape people's ideas. It shapes what people think about, how they feel, and what they make, you know, what kind of decisions they make in life. It alters, it somehow forms a kind of idea in their mind that leads them to a specific direction that, again, leads them to make a specific decision in life. The social media is at times so much more influential than books because it entails people's emotions. It penetrates into people's hearts and, you know, of course, through their eyesight. So be very careful at what you are, you know, viewing on the social media. And if you can, if you have the knowledge and if you have the talent, try to create Islamic captions, Islamic posts, or Islamic whatever, you know, messages on the social media. God bless you all, and wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Aminolemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
On Thursday, Italy's outgoing government discussed an energy-saving plan during a Council of Ministers aimed to save up for this winter as part of efforts to reduce the country's dependency on Russian gas. Ecological Transition Minister Roberto Cingolani's plan includes limiting the use of heating in apartment blocks and public buildings. Italians will be demanded to turn down the central heating by 1 degree and turn it off for an hour at dusk every day starting in October. Italy is struggling with increased energy costs as wholesale gas prices have surged to historic levels across Europe since the start of the conflict in Ukraine.
Italy and a few other countries, including Belgium and the Czech Republic, are among those seeking an EU price cap on gas for power, but some members of the bloc, including France, are against this option. An emergency meeting of European Union energy ministers will be held in Brussels on September 9 to reach a consensus on tackling skyrocketing power costs.
We have a big gas problem. Our families and businesses are struggling, and politicians keep talking about making more debt to alleviate the crisis. But that would just be a patchwork. Italy must leave the TTF, the virtual trading point for natural gas based in the Netherlands, and then we can discuss a new LNG strategy.
Meanwhile, the Italian Confederation of Enterprises, Confcommercio, has warned some 120,000 Italian service sector firms could go out of business over the next 10 months.
I costi dell'energia sono ormai la vera emergenza.
The rise of energy costs is the real emergency. Service sector firms will spend a total of 33 billion euros on energy bills, three times as much as in 2021. The government must speed up the procedures to access the funds of the EU Energy Recovery Fund and to make sure that the price cap on gas for power is adopted.
If energy costs keep rising at the current pace, Confcommercio, which has estimated that 370,000 jobs are at risk, is calling on the government to extend tax relief and to mandate that bills can be paid in smaller installments. The bad news for Italy doesn't stop there. Inflation jumped to 9% in August from 8.4% the month before. Financial analysts expect inflation to grow further, reaching 10% in October. Max Civili, Rome.
The China Global Television Network and Chinese Public Opinion Institute have conducted a survey in Afghanistan and 24 global countries to assess the 20-year American war on Afghanistan.
Now, the Taliban will pay a price.
At the beginning of its presence in Afghanistan, the U.S. made a commitment to build a stable, strong, and prosperous Afghanistan, claiming it would establish democracy, fight against terrorism, and rebuild the nation. Nearly 79% of the Afghan respondents polled said the U.S. did not keep its promise, while 80% termed the U.S. war in their country a complete failure.
The U.S. never abided by its promises. Current disasters in Afghanistan have all resulted from the U.S. failures. We would witness better days today if the U.S. hadn't occupied our country. 20 years ago, the Taliban were ruling Afghanistan, and today they have control again. So what did the years of U.S. war and huge expenses change in our country? The U.S. claimed to bring prosperity in Afghanistan. Instead, it destroyed everything.
During the war, Afghanistan faced severe challenges with regards to security, economy, and people's livelihoods. Some 56.6% of Afghan respondents said the U.S. left the Afghan economy worse than it was in 2001. Yet 80% of global respondents believe that the causes of local terrorism still exist in the war-ravaged country.
I've been in Afghanistan through the U.S. invasion. I agree with the results of the poll. The U.S. came to our country claiming to counter terrorism and help the Afghan economy grow, but practically none of them materialized. The U.S. institutionalized fraud and abuse. As a result, today Afghans don't have food to eat and terrorism threats are rising.
Meanwhile, 68% of the respondents said the U.S. war in Afghanistan has caused the U.S. to continue to lose its credibility with the international community. Some 65% of those surveyed in Afghanistan said they believe neighboring countries, including Iran, Pakistan, and China, play a key role in the rebuilding of the war-battered nation. 70% of global respondents described Washington seizing Afghanistan's assets as pure looting. They called on the U.S. to return Afghans' money. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
On the 44th anniversary of the disappearance of Imam Musa Sadr, Lebanese Parliament Speaker Nabih Biri stressed that the kidnapping of the prominent Shiite cleric was a crime that is a sovereign Lebanese case.
The failure of the current Libyan authorities to cooperate with the Lebanese authorities is considered to be collusion. The Arab League must press the authorities to cooperate.
Commenting on the issue of the demarcation of the country's southern maritime border with the Israeli occupying regime, the House Speaker accused the U.S. envoy of buying time.
We will not concede our rights, nor will we concede our sovereignty, and we will defend our land, sea, and resources with all our might. The ball now is in the court of the U.S. The U.S. envoy Hochstein said that he will be absent for 2 weeks, but 1 month has passed and we have not received an answer.
People from all over the country came to the southern town of Tyre to commemorate the man who was seen as a hope for the oppressed and a reason to stop internal strife.
I don't have much to say except that I'm touched by all this love for Imam Sadr. May God uncover his fate.
Imam Sadr resembles the light, the beam of light that at a certain time, in the midst of darkness, came to Lebanon and led Lebanon and the Lebanese to a new life, life of accepting the other, of cherishing the other, life of victory.
You see, you can have tears when you see all these people are coming, just because that person is a very exceptional. He came as a blessing from the sky, I would consider, in the middle amongst of all when Lebanon was suffering and still suffering.
The only verified fact concerning Imam Sadr's case was that he arrived in the Libyan capital of Tripoli at the end of August 1978 with two companions, Sheikh Mohammed Yaqub and journalist Abbas Badreddin. Back then, the regime of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi had claimed that the three men
ordered a flight to Italy on August 31st, but al-Sadr and his companions were never seen again.
Many had hoped that the fall of former dictator Muammar al-Qaddafi would reveal the secrets about the disappearance of Sayyid Musa Sadr. But those secrets were buried with the Libyan dictator, which led to a dead-end investigation. Maryam Saleh from Tyre, South Lebanon.
The Iranian Foreign Minister's short notice visit to Russia carries major messages, as it comes at a time when Tehran is carefully examining the recent U.S. draft response to the 2015 deal, which holds Russia as one of its signatories. Hossein Amir Abdullahian was warmly greeted in Moscow on Wednesday by his Russian counterpart Sergei Lavrov. The Russian foreign minister once again reaffirmed his country's support for a fair deal or no deal.
The Russian Federation shares the same stances as Iran towards the 2015 deal. We believe that the U.S.'s illegal sanctions against Iran must be removed to save the deal.
Meanwhile, Tehran and Washington are currently exchanging comments on the European Union's new draft proposal for the revival of what is known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action. Iran has repeatedly said it wants a sustainable accord, which includes guarantees that would make the deal immune to any possible withdrawal by the U.S. administration.
My colleagues are thoroughly reviewing the American text. We seek stronger and more reliable guarantees from the U.S. to prevent any future withdrawal from the deal by the U.S. government.
The 2015 deal was cast into limbo in 2018 when Washington unilaterally walked out of the accord and reinstated sanctions on Tehran. Iran, in return, scaled back some of its commitments to the pact, saying it will return to its obligations only after the U.S. removes all anti-Iran sanctions. The Vienna talks over the revival of the accord have faced a hiatus over the past 5 months. The discussions are now set to resume after Iran approves and accepts the U.S. draft response.
The Iranian foreign minister's visit to Moscow is of great significance, since Russia is a key player in the 2015 deal and shares Iran's stance in the accord. Now, while the United States' response to the EU draft proposal is still under examination in Tehran, here, Sergei Lavrov says Russia will accept nothing less than Tehran's full rights under the agreement. Yusuf Jalali, Moscow.
On the 30th of August last year, the last of the U.S. troops hastily left Kabul International Airport, marking the end of a two-decade occupation of Afghanistan. On its anniversary, the people of Afghanistan are celebrating this occasion. They say being independent and free from any occupation is a great blessing for the nation.
This is a victorious day for Afghans. 1 year ago, the U.S. occupying forces were forced to leave Afghanistan. Of course, they were defeated against the will of our people. We are proud that another invasion failed in our country.
Most Afghan people believe the U.S. invasion brought them nothing but more conflict, poverty, destruction, and suffering. They say today it is Afghans who are in charge of their own country and that they should work to build their homeland.
In the past 20 years, we didn't witness anything except bombardments, destruction, and civilian casualties. People across the country were busy burying their loved ones every day.
We have gathered here to mark Afghanistan's independence from the U.S. occupation. Last year, on this day, the U.S. withdrew from our country. We are happy that the U.S. is no more present here. But unfortunately, our country is reeling from economic problems. I hope the new rules of Afghanistan provide job opportunities and protect the rights of all Afghans.
Participants also called on the U.S. to learn from its past mistakes and stop the ongoing ill policies towards Afghanistan and its people. 1 year on, Afghans are celebrating the U.S. withdrawal from their country. People here say they are happy that the U.S. invasion was ended because they were exhausted by Americans' gross violations. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
England's healthcare service workers receiving national praise for staying in the job through the grueling days of the pandemic to save lives. an increasing number of them, doctors, nurses, and midwives, have either quit the service or are actively considering to do so.
Profits have risen by 35% in the UK since the pandemic. More money to the rich, but not to those that are sick or for people that care for them.
The most recent culprit, poor pay. Rejecting a 4% pay increase in the face of soaring inflation, they're set to vote for industrial action.
Even with all those budgeting, we are still struggling. And so what would help when the NHS really was to increase our salary like everybody else is getting bonuses, we are not. Why? Why is this? And if you're not going to increase our salary, at least do something about transportation or even the parking. We can't be paying for things like this. It's ridiculous.
There are other reasons, too, for the exodus. A recent survey by union-led With NHS Staff Campaign found stress, burnout, a feeling of abandonment after the pandemic. Some are having to use food banks or sleep inside hospitals. And it doesn't stop there.
There were other abuses of staff which made themselves clear, which also manifested. And actually, a large part of the nursing workforce who want to learn also cite discrimination. And there's a large amount of bullying, harassment, intimidation, discrimination that goes hand in hand with not every environment within the NHS, but within certain environments.
More people leaving the NHS means more work to be done by those who stay while they wait for the tens of thousands of vacancies across the country to be filled. A negative spiral hard to overcome in addition to the cost of living crisis. And then there's the years of underfunding and a wholesale drive to privatization, regardless of which party is in power.
The plan to privatize the NHS is not piecemeal, it's wholesale. I'm afraid Labour and Tory are like this. There isn't a fundamental difference in their attitude. We're already facing a winter bed crisis now. It's August, okay? And it's only going to get worse through the winter. So there is an under-provision in order to force people who can't get adequate care from the NHS into the private sector.
Created after World War II by a Labour government, the NHS is a publicly funded healthcare system, free at the point of need. Decades later, though, it's facing acute staff shortages, underfunding, and rapid privatization, which means that the crown jewel of Britain's public healthcare provision may soon be no more. Saipur is up, London.
Pakistan is racing against time to prevent further loss of life and accelerate aid deliveries to those affected by relentless monsoon rains and devastating flooding, which have led to a staggering number of casualties and caused billions of dollars in damage. Fears of flooding around the riverbanks prompted thousands from north to south to flee their homes. With some living on highways with their livestock, miles away from their flooded villages and towns, many still are not ready to leave their houses underwater.
Our houses have been washed away with floods, with everything we had. We have nothing to lose now. We are living in miserable conditions and waiting for help from the government.
Millions of Pakistanis affected by the worst flooding in a decade are in desperate need of aid. Thousands are living in temporary shelters, as the authorities say they have been overwhelmed by the scale of the disaster.
We evacuated people from low-lying areas. Almost around 50,000 people were evacuated within a span of 10 hours. The relief side is ongoing. The district administration is providing meals, medicines, lodging, and all other facilities.
Press TV's crew visited a flood-hit region on the bank of River Kabul in Nowshera district of one of the worst-hit provinces of Pakistan, Khyber Pakhtunkhwa. Powerful flash floods caused the Kabul River to swell, sweeping away bridges overnight, cutting off the local population from road access. However, rescue workers say that they have managed to save the lives of thousands of residents thanks to early evacuations.
We remain successful in preventing life losses as our rescue teams make it possible to evacuate people before the flood water hits the nearby population on the bank of River Kabul. Now we are trying to deliver food via boats to the people who are still stranded in flood water.
Relief camps have been established by the Pakistani government in various parts of the country for flood victims. However, many remote regions are still waiting for rescue teams.
The remains of the flood show the intensity of the disaster.